Well, welcome. We are glad to be able to gather this weekend. My name's Matt Williams, and I have that distinct honor of being able to lead on the teaching side of things, so we're grateful to be able to do it. Before we jump into the book of Esther, let me just kind of let you know something that's going on this weekend to be thinking about, praying about, particularly for their safety, but also for their spiritual growth. We sent hundreds of high school students away for the weekend. And so we didn't send them away forever, right? We just sent them away for the weekend. We are excited. It's a forge retreat for our high school student ministry. And when you include the adults and all the people serving behind the scenes and leading small groups and worship and all the logistics, it's almost 500 people. So about 400 students. And we're really excited about this for a number of reasons. We believe that that's such a formative, distinct time in the life of our young people. And what you'll see is that for the average student who grows up in church, when they get to about 10th grade, they're starting to check out. 11th grade, they're done. 12th grade, you've never seen them again. And they just start to, the family starts to pull apart right there, and they begin to dictate the terms of what they'll do with their spiritual life. And so you begin to see them fall off. And so we would like to see that trend reversed in the context of our church and with people that we are reaching. And so we would love to see that family continue to worship together. We would love to see students continue to grow in their faith. And so we have Bill White's teaching and Chris Curtis and I think Daniel Moore and Schofield Foster. And one of the most exciting things is some of those students within the larger body are serving. And so it is a time to serve and give and sacrifice and grow and be taught and be trained. And so we're really excited about it, but want you to be praying for them. What we don't want is to create a generation of people who grew up in church, who wander away during their 20s, who almost destroy themselves and have to have life-altering, cataclysmic events to bring them back in their 30s. We would love to see them just remain faithful all the way through. So that's part of what we are trying to create. So be praying for them. Grab a Bible. Turn to Esther chapter 5. We're going to do 5 and 6. We were talking about as a team, and we were going to break these two chapters out, but I couldn't do it. So why do less when you can do more? Why leave people energized when you can exhaust them, right? So all week, cutting stuff out, trying not to wear you out too much. Chapter 5 and chapter 6, the recap of the book is pretty simple. It's this. It's that the Jews are doomed. They've been targeted, and they are going to be destroyed as a nation. That Mordecai is communicating to his kind of adopted daughter, you are queen, you need to go do something for us. You need to go intercede and talk to the king. She says, I don't really have access to do that. It's a dangerous proposition. I might get killed. He says, listen, you're going to die anyway, Mr. Compassion. You're going to die anyway. And you need to seize this opportunity. Maybe this is why you were appointed to be able to do this. Maybe you being queen is not even about you. And so she makes peace with dying for this cause, and she begins to offer her life. She goes to meet the king, and she's going to serve, and she's going to try to serve her people. And so I got a great email this week. It challenged something, young gal in our church. She challenged something that I said at the end of the sermon, which I thought I was expecting more challenge on it. So one of the last slides that I put up, I said, your value is in serving God. And so when I use the word value, that's definitely pushing the envelope. But I acknowledged and I said, in the grand scheme, our value is in the fact that God created us and Jesus died on the cross to pay for our sins. That's where our real value comes from. But in that context, Esther has the choice of saying, my value is in my status as queen and the luxury therein, the life that I have. That's my valuable contribution and that's my identity. But she rejects that and says, my value is in being a child and a servant of God and his people. And so I'm going to show my value in advancing the kingdom, being a part of what God's doing. And I'm going to make that sacrifice. And then we're going to see that God rescues her. And so she's going to experience how much God loves her and how much he cares for her. So she could go to Starbucks and talk about with her friends, drink some coffee, what does it mean to be a Christian and how much God loves me. But she chose to jump in, and now she experiences it. And so the value that she has in God is now something that's part of her experience. So it's a great, great challenge and a great idea, and we're nuancing the language a little bit. So I hope you can appreciate some of that. Let's look at chapter 5. We're going to see some pride that's so repulsive. We're so glad that that's not us, that this is the problem that other people have with their pride, and we don't have to deal with it. But, you know, we just humor ourselves by reading it together. We'll see. So let me read through. We'll start in verse 1. She makes this request of the king. On the third day of the fast, she says, go pray for me, or go fast for me for 3 days. And so for 3 days, she has the idea that she's going to die hanging over her. So death hangs over her for 3 days. She goes to see the king, royal robes. She entered the court, the palace, just across from the king's hall. The king was sitting on his throne facing the entrance. When he saw her, she's going to die because she walked into that room without being invited, but he welcomed her and he held out the gold scepter. So after 3 days of thinking of having death hanging over her, life is extended to her by the king. It's kind of an interesting allusion. I don't make too much out of it, but it is an interesting idea. She's going to intercede for these people, and God's there to provide for her. Verse 3, the king asked her, what do you want, Queen Esther? What is your request? Now notice this. This is very nice. He goes, I will give it to you. I don't even know what it is. I'm going to give it to you. I like you so much. Which does raise questions of why he hadn't asked for it in 30 days if he likes her so much. But I'll give it to you, even up to half the kingdom. It's a Near Eastern ancient way of saying, I'm so favorable to you. It's kind of a phrase, right? It's kind of a saying. It just says, I'm inclined to do whatever you want. I look on you with favor. So here's what happened. She didn't die. That's a good thing. Good for her. Good for us. She was protected. She put her life at risk, and God rescued her. That's what I would say. Verse 4. She replied, if it pleased the king, I'd like to have the king and Haman come to a banquet today. What I label in my notes as the luncheon, because there's two banquets. There's the banquet immediate, and she's going to invite him to another one. I always write in my notes, this is the luncheon. She brings out some chicken salad with some, you know, she put the nuts and the grapes in it. Women like that, and that's probably what she's doing. But she, she invites him and Haman into a banquet. It is a culture of honor. That's a very honoring thing to do. In verse 6, so they were drinking wine. The king is not altogether dense either. There's a part of him that knows what's going on. The king says to her in verse 6, now won't you tell me what you really want? He's got her, right? Won't you tell me what you really want? What is your request? And he says it again, I'm very favorable. I give you up to half the kingdom. She says, this is my request, my deepest wish. If it pleases the king, I want you and Haman to come tomorrow to another banquet, the real banquet. I want you to come tomorrow to another one. So what's she doing? We have no idea. I mean, I've read everybody there is to read. We don't really know. Here's what we know. We know that it's a culture of honor. All right. We know that by having a party thrown in your name, being honored that way, we know that's a big deal. I mean, it's a big deal here, but it's really a big deal there. So we know that. We also know she's probably the smartest person in the room. So when you put those two things together, it's a culture of honor. She's the sharpest one around. Then we know that she is shrewd. We know that she is clever. We don't know exactly what she's doing, but here's what we know. We know that she knows what she's doing. She's got something figured out. So she's risked her life to approach. She says, come to a banquet that warms the room. He says, what do you really want? She goes, come to another banquet. That warms it even further. Now, here's what she has communicated to him. The thing I'm getting ready to ask you, it is a big deal. So that whole half the kingdom thing, hang on. So he at least knows that this is she's going to ask for something and it's a big deal. Here's where the tension starts to appear in verse 9. Haman was a happy man. He was a happy man as he left the lunch, what I call the luncheon, the banquet. And when he saw Mordecai sitting at the palace gate, he's strolling along so happy. But Mordecai was not standing or trembling nervously before him. And Haman became furious. However, he restrained himself, which tells you how furious he is that he has to restrain himself just to go home. So when a banquet, good day, invited to another banquet, he's headed home, he's so happy, he runs into Mordecai, and Mordecai's perspective is so different than everybody else's around him. Mordecai is not looking at him. You know, it's one thing to challenge someone. It shows that they're important enough to get angry at or to be frustrated with. He's not even important enough in Mordecai's eyes to stand, to be nervous, to be frustrated, to be angry with. He just dismisses him altogether. And it just makes Haman furious. So angry that he has to restrain himself. And so that leads us to the initial point, what I've said. We're going to see an astounding amount of pride in Haman. And we're going to get to diagnose it and think about it for a minute. We're going to recognize that I got the same stuff going on, and that leads us somewhere. It leads us somewhere important. So here's how mad he is. He goes home in the end of verse 10, and he gathers together. Haman gathers together his friends and Zeresh his wife. So he's got to go get their advisors. His advisors and his friends and his wife, and he gets them in the den, and he says, "Hey, turn the TV off. Now listen. Listen, I got to tell you something." He's so mad. And look, this is what he says to him. He boasts to them about his great wealth and his many children. He's like, "You don't even know." Wait, you do know. Like, why is he bragging to his wife and his most intimate friends? "And I've got this many kids." And they're going, "We know you do. And here's my role in the kingdom." And they're like, "We know that's your role." And so he brags to his wife and to his best friends about how wealthy he is, about how powerful he is, about all his children, everything that the king had given him and how he'd been promoted, all the other nobles. And so he's bragging to people who already know this. So it just shows the undoing of this man. He's getting to a place where he's starting to unravel. You go, well, why does he do that? There's an empty place deep inside of him, and we all get this. Some of us are plagued with it in a greater, more profound way than others. But there's a part of him that is empty, that needs to be validated, that needs to be affirmed. And when you live your life demanding that other people value you and affirm you to that degree all the time, it destroys friendships, it destroys marriages, it destroys working relationships, it destroys with your boss, with the people that work with you, people work around you. It's cancerous. And so he's got some of that. Chronically prideful. So I just thought, just jotted down, we talked about it, some of the folks on staff, we talked about this week, and I circulated something, we just thought through it. There's at least four things that are here, right, just to think about. For chronically prideful people like him, like me, like some of you, here's some things that you can diagnose yourself on. If you're a person, you get your feelings hurt all the time. You go, "I'm real sensitive." You might be. That might be true. There's sensitive people and there's less sensitive people. But just as a general rule, if you're a person that gets your feelings hurt all the time, then you have to ask some questions about what is underlying that. What are my expectations of people? And what do I have for them? Why am I so important and so fragile that my feelings are always getting hurt? Another one is when you're always looking to be honored. If you're the gal or the guy, and people just don't remember to tell you thank you. Like, I wonder why they don't thank me. Or you know, you do something for someone and then you realize I don't think they're that grateful for what I did for them. When you feel like it's not just your job to serve people, it's now your job now to measure their gratefulness. Just like, you know what? I don't know if anybody's been measuring gratefulness recently, and I think I probably should do that for them. Here's what I've decided about how grateful they are or they're not. And then you have to go back and ask yourself, why is it that I need people to thank me and I need people to be grateful? You're like, well, that's a character issue. People should be grateful. That's true. But then I have to ask the question of why is it that I feel like I'm the judge of whether they are being grateful or not? How much conflict do you have? Prideful people, as a general rule, find themselves in conflict all the time. They're always critiquing something or they're not tolerating being critiqued. And so they are in conflict all the time. They're generally not peacemakers because you got to humble yourself to make peace. So they're always in conflict. Or being wrong is not an option for them. And when I say them, I mean, I'm talking about my family will be in the mix this weekend. They'll be like, ah, no, Dad, you just looked at your own journal and wrote those things down, right? But being wrong is not an option. And I think about a guy that I know that goes to our church. I consider him young. I guess he's not young anymore. And he is extremely passionate. And when you watch him argue for his point, he's right all the time about all kinds of stuff. When you watch him argue for his point, there's a part of you that says, he's real strong. He might be real prideful. But here's what I've noticed. He's very passionate. And we've all got pride, but he's so passionate, it's actually a little different than pride, because in his mind, being wrong is an option. Because there have been times when he and I are in this heated discussion about something, and I can say, no, no, hang on. And I'm a little bit older, so slightly wiser on a good day. I can say, no, no, there's A and there's B, and then together that's C. And I can't tell you the number of times he's gone, huh, I didn't know that. And he's like, okay, I'm good. That makes sense. And so for him, being wrong is an option. So he looks prideful on the outside, but when you get down to it, he's actually okay to be wrong. And you could take another personality that's much more subdued and quiet, would never say anything, never challenge anybody, and in their spirit, they could be completely welled up, and they don't ever think that they're wrong. So don't let personality of the outgoing, talkative person or the quiet person determine in your mind, not that it's our job to determine, right? But don't get deceived into thinking, well, since I'm the quiet personality, I'm probably real humble, and that person talks all the time. She's always talking. I know she must be prideful. She's not near as humble as I am, right? Something to think about, because this is a central part of what Christianity is. We got to give it its due. Verse 12. And then Haman, he's not done. Talking to his wife and his people. He's not done. And that's not all. I just think it's funny. Queen Esther invited only me and the king. Who gets mentioned first? Me. Only me and the king himself to the banquet prepared for us. She's invited me to dine with her and king again tomorrow. And then he added, but this is so amazing. Underline this. But this is all worth nothing as long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting there at the palace gate. He goes, 2 days in a row, I'm eating with the king and the queen. Boom. You know me. That's how I am. That's how I roll. That's where I live. You know that's what I do. And his pride has made him weak and predictable, and he is most of all a slave to his emotions. And I know exactly what this feels like, a slave to his emotions. But notice that phrase, but it is everything that I have, my wife and my children and my status and everything I can do and everything I've accomplished and my big house and all of this power, all of it means nothing because Mordecai sits at the gate. He doesn't cry when he sees me. He's not afraid. He just keeps sitting there like he has a right to sit there. I mean, they're waiting for some point, right? But it's just offensive to his pride. It's odious. So here's the why. Why? Why is it if you have all this going on, all the money, all the power, the wife, the children, why you have everything going for you, why is it that the one thing holds you up? Have you ever felt that? You ever had anybody ask you that? Why, with everything that you have going on, why the one thing over here? Let's leave us out of it. Let's go back to him. Why for him? Here's what I would tell you in my language. He has the soul of a king. That's what he's got. It's the soul of a king. See, a king is defined as someone who rules. And if there's something within that kingdom that doesn't line up, that doesn't rule, it's a threat to who he is. It's a threat to the ego. I'm just speaking humanly, right? It's a threat to the, so you got to suppress it. Got to put it down. Got to deal with it. His soul is that I have the soul of a king. I should be ruling all of this. People should be listening to me, following me. There should be no threats, anything. There should be nothing in my sight that is a challenge to me. Everything should be submissive to me up underneath me. And I can't rest until it is. It is an arrogant soul that just says, I'm really, really important. Everything should come up underneath me. The Bible talks about this from the beginning to the end of the condition of our heart as it comes to pride. So there's a few proverbs I want to show you from chapter 16. I think verse 5, the Lord detests the proud. They'll surely be punished. So that's not a good thing when you have the sovereign of the universe saying he wants to punish you. Verse 8, the same chapter, pride goes before destruction, haughtiness before a fall. In Hebrew, it kind of rhymes. So in English, it's very common in English to know it. But he says this: there's a predictable pattern, because when you're prideful, you put yourself in a predictable pattern. You're a slave to your emotions. A fall is inevitable. It's not magic. It's just practical. And then 32, better to be patient. And this doesn't distinctly deal, just it doesn't have the word pride in it. This is one of my favorite verses. Better to be patient than powerful. Better to have self-control than to conquer a city. He goes, better to be able to control your emotions, your pride, your energy, than to be the king over the city. I mean, I was in my 20s first time I read that verse. I was like, I'm doomed. Like, I'm never going to make it. I'm never going to make it. Too hard. 1 Peter 5. Little New Testament here. So humble yourselves under the mighty power of God, or the mighty hand of God, and at the right time, he will lift you up in honor. So the ability to trust him and say, well, I'm not a king. I don't need the soul of a king. I serve the king. And so I'm free to humble myself. He'll exalt me when he's ready, if he wants to, in his time and his way. So those are some reminders. This behavior and this attitude that we have, the behavior that I have, the attitude that I have, tells me a lot about what's going on in my heart. And we'll come back to it. Verse 14. So Haman's wife, Zeresh, with all his friends, suggested, this is her wisdom to him. This is her counsel. I've been home a lot of days and said, babe, this is my situation. What do you think I should do? This has never been in the prescript. And there have been days I thought, man, she needs to read this. This is good counsel. Set up a sharpened pole that stands 75 feet tall. I mean, how in the world are you going to get people up there, right? Set up a sharpened pole that stands 75 feet tall, and in the morning ask the king to impale Mordecai on it. Drive a pole through his body. I'm tired of hearing you talk about this dude. And when this is done, you can go your merry way. Go to your banquet. I mean, you just run the pole right through his body and all the guts and everything come out. And then you can go eat. It's funny. Then you'll be free to enjoy dinner, lunch. And this pleased Haman. And he ordered the pole to be set up. He's like, woman, you're brilliant. But here's the problem. Is that she has an opportunity to tell him the truth. The problem with the truth is going to wound him. And so she doesn't want to wound. We don't know. I can't go too far. I don't know what her deal is. But she has a chance to truth him and to wound him, and she won't do it. And so Proverbs 27:6 says this. And this applies to your marriage, to your children, to whatever, brothers and sisters in Christ. Wounds from a sincere friend are better than many kisses from an enemy. She has a chance to tell him the truth, and maybe she doesn't know the truth, but she has a chance to move him in the right direction. But it's going to be so painful for him to hear the truth and have to deal with his own soul that probably nobody's going to survive it. But here's the other thing, not beating up on her. He goes to a place to find what he wants. He knows exactly where he's going, to his friends, his advisors, his wife, who are going to tell him what he wants to hear, which does have something to do with us. I've noticed in our church context is that most of us, not other churches and other in the culture, I'm talking about us, is that we do not go looking for what might be best that glorifies God. We go looking for counsel that is comforting to us. And we have people who are more than willing to be more enemy to us than friend to us, because they want you to like them. So they don't tell you the truth because they want you to like them. And so we wind up going and looking for comfort rather than the truth. And so many times we survey people and we survey people until we find comfort, until we find the right answer. well, I mean, I didn't like what he said, so I'm going to go to him. And so, and there have been times when someone, when I've been asked to speak into something, and I say something that maybe doesn't feel like good, like, well, see, I have two other people who said something else. I was like, oh, okay, well, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I don't know everything. That seems to not really go with Scripture, but I mean, I don't, like I said, I don't know everything. Can give some good advice sometimes, but it just, sometimes it feels like we are looking for comfort rather than the truth. So it's tough on us. Verse chapter 6. Now the scene changes. We'll come back to this idea, but the scene changes. Chapter 6, verse 1. That night, so the night before what? The night before the banquet, when she asked the big question, and the night before Mordecai is impaled on the pole. So the night before all that. That night, the king had trouble sleeping. So he ordered an attendant to bring the book of the history of his reign so it could be read to him. And in those records, he discovered an account of how Mordecai had exposed the plot of the two eunuchs who guarded him at the door of the king's private quarters and how they had plotted to assassinate him. Now notice how random everything is, right? It's the night before the banquet, and it's the night before Mordecai is going to get impaled, which the king doesn't know that yet. And he has this night, he just can't sleep. And so he calls in, he could count sheep, he could look at the constellations, but he calls a servant, he goes, hey, read to me the book. No, not the old book, the one that's a little more recent. So he picks the right book, and he reads the right story, and he's reminded of Mordecai. Verse 3, he goes, what reward or recognition did we give Mordecai for this? Which is a hallmark of Persian kings. They're very generous. He goes, what do we give him? And he says, we didn't give him anything. Which does not make him look good. Doesn't make him feel good. Verse 4. Who is that at the outer court? The king inquired. Notice the phrasing. As it happened. Incidentally. By coincidence. Haman had just arrived in the outer court of the palace to ask the king to impale Mordecai on a pole he had prepared. You're like, this is fascinating. Right? It just so happened, what an amazing coincidence, that the king was talking about Mordecai because it showed up in the book, and Haman shows up in outside the room to say, hey, incidentally, I was just wondering if maybe in the morning I could kill Mordecai. So all this is happening at the same time. What a coincidence. So the attendants replied to the king, it's Haman, he's out in the court. He goes, bring him in. So Haman came in, the king said, Hey, no. Before you ask me your thing, I'm sure what you got to say is important, but just, I've been thinking. This is the king. What should I do to honor the man who truly pleases me? What do you think, Haman? What should I do for the guy who truly pleases me? And Haman thought to himself, which don't do. He goes, whom would the king wish to honor more than me? It is the story of the prideful woman or the prideful man that cannot for 10 minutes get themselves off the throne of their own life. I mean, well, obviously, if he's talking about honoring someone, he's obviously talking about me. Who else would he want to honor more than me? I mean, I am the center of the universe and everything. And so, in a practical sense, his pride limits his ability to think critically. It limits his ability to influence others. Hard to influence other people when all you think about is yourself. Right? Hard to put yourself in their shoes and go, this is what might be best for them, or here's how they can get to where they need to be, or how we can make this whole thing work to benefit something else besides me. That's just not really an option. So he's always thinking about himself. It's always about him. So who would the king want to honor more than me? So with that in mind, if it's me, here's how I'm going to answer the king's question. Verse 7. If the king wishes to honor me, I mean someone, he should bring out one of the king's royal robes as well as a horse that the king himself has ridden. So royal robes, royal horse. And with the royal emblem on his head and wear the royal jewelry, let the robes and the horse be handed over to one of the king's noble officials and let him see the man whom the king wishes to honor is dressed in the king's robes and led through the city. Have the officials shout as they go, this is what the king does for someone he wishes to honor. So you got to put all the royal stuff on him and then have an announcer, an MC, walk him through the city and make sure that everybody knows this. Now, it is interesting what he chooses. You know, what should I do to honor the man who I really want to honor? Well, you should give him $1 million. You should put him in charge of the province over there, the big one. But that's not what he chooses. He chooses a horse that the king rode on, the robe that the king wears, the emblem, the jewelry, the crown, whatever that the king wears. It's all the royal stuff. Why? Because that's what he wants to be. I mean, it's a direct assault on the king, and the king would probably perceive it that way, except that the king's not thinking about Haman. He's thinking about somebody else, so he's not really threatened. But if he knew Haman was thinking about himself in this light, he'd probably just kill him right there. I'm speculating, right? But it's the soul of a king he has, and he craves it. He's dying for that kind of validation. He's dying for that kind of talk, that kind of energy, that kind of respect. For he wants men and women to look at him and think royalty, feel royalty. He wants them to tremble and to quake. He wants them before him kneeling. He wants all of that. And then in verse 10, the king is like, God, you're so smart. How you come up with stuff off the top of your head like that? He goes, excellent. So take the robes and my horse and do just as you have said for Mordecai the Jew. He's like, wait, Mordecai that I came here to kill? So I came in to kill Mordecai, and now I'm leaving having to exalt him. He goes, if you don't know where he is, he's the Jew. And he sits in the gate of the palace all the time. He's like, yeah, I think I know where he sits, right? So everything has gotten reversed. And so he does lead him through, he dresses him up and he leads him through the city, and you can just see Haman holding the rope going, this is what the king does for people he wants to. He probably does a terrible job, right? Verse 12, afterward, Mordecai returned to the palace gate, and Haman hurried home, dejected and completely humiliated. So there's a reverse. Came to kill Mordecai, and I have to glorify Mordecai. I came to be up here, and now I'm down here. I came to get satisfaction and resolution over this, and I leave with more angst and more anger and more frustration and dejected and even overwhelmed now. And then in verse 13, and when Haman told his wife, Zeresh, and all his friends what had happened, his wise advisors and his wife, that since Mordecai, i.e., this man who has humiliated you, is of Jewish birth, you will never succeed in your plans against him. He's thinking, where was that advice yesterday? He's like, why didn't you tell me that yesterday? I wasn't going to succeed. And we don't know. We don't know the answers to all that. It is interesting that she says, this man is Jewish by birth. You'll never succeed against him. It does raise the question, is she thinking, because they're Jewish, because their God takes care of them, we'll never succeed? We don't know. Silent on that. Verse 14. And while they were still talking, the king's eunuchs arrived and quickly took Haman to the banquet Esther had prepared. Time just starts to take off. The beginning of the book, everything happens so slowly. There's years and months in between the events. And now it feels like this one who's been driving the story and he's been pushing everybody forward for what he wants. Now things have broken loose and they're out of his control and he's digging his heels in and they're coming for him, is the idea. Everything's out of his control now. And what Jesus says does come true here, and we'll see it next week clearly. In Matthew 23, though, Jesus puts it like this. The greatest among you must be a servant, but those who exalt themselves will be humbled. And then those who humble themselves will be exalted. Now, this works on multiple levels. You want access to God, you got to humble yourself, right? And then he'll exalt. But it also is a practical part of how we live. Let me just give you, it just hit me this week. It's just, you know, normal life stuff that happens all the time. And I thought, this is a pretty good illustration of this. So I risked myself and my family again. So I pick up one of my daughters from somewhere, and we're talking. And she starts telling me the story of this girl who has told her something that is inflammatory and arrogant and prideful and unfounded and braggadocious. And as she's telling me that, right, it's kind of humorous for someone to be bragging about something that's so far removed from where they really are. And so as we're talking through that, it's peculiarly close to where one of my daughters lives, right, and what she does, right? So it's some of those things that girl's saying are true, are actually true of her, but not true of her. And so it hits close. And so it was inflammatory. And she is just enraged is too strong, but she was just inflamed by the whole thing. And so as we're riding down the road, I said, you know what's interesting I said, I completely agree with you. I said, it is ridiculous for her to say that to you and to have that posture in life, not just towards you, but towards anyone, have that posture. I said, it's kind of ridiculous. I said, but you know what's interesting is the reaction that that creates in you, how strong your reaction is. And that's where it just kind of stinks being my child, right? Because she's like, you know, here I am being vulnerable with my dad, an unguarded moment, and he's going to turn it around, try to teach me something. Can't just be a daughter, right? So I feel that. So I just said, let me level the playing field, which means I'll tell you how bad I am. So I told a story of when someone did the same thing to me a year ago or so, and how that just their braggadocious, they're arrogant, they're really posturing. Pastors are the worst. The posturing of it just ignited something in me. And I wanted to just set him straight and be like, bro, that wasn't even y'all's idea. You want me to show you where that idea came from? I mean, right? It just wells up. I said, so you're feeling it and I felt it and most everybody has felt it. We handle it differently depending on your personality, but we've all felt it. I said, but it shows a symptom of something inside of me that's broken. It shows that something inside of me is clamoring for meaning and clamoring for attention and clamoring for validation. And one of my great fears is that you might be validated for something you haven't done and I would miss out on the credit that I deserve and I did do it. It shows a deep wound and a deep, dark place in my soul. And so if I stand on stage and say, Jesus is sufficient for me, is that actually true? In some ways, it's not true. He can be, but he's not because I'm not trusting in that. I mean, it just opens you up. And I said, so you're guilty, you're sick on this, and I am too. I said, but let me just say, there's two gifts that God has given us in this moment. The first one is he's given us eyes to see and the freedom to see. Because see, if I have to earn my way with God and I have to prove that I'm good enough, then I got to cover up these great deficits, these deep wounds, these places in me that are dark and that are offensive and that aren't whole or healed or that aren't just stable, that are selfish and prideful. I had to cover all that up. But because I've associated myself with Jesus, baptized, take communion, I've already told you how bad I am. So when you find this out about me, you're like, yeah, it's what we thought. He told us it was bad. Why else would Jesus die if it wasn't bad? And he's associated himself with Jesus' death. This sin must be bad. So, I mean, we're free. We don't have to posture and cover all that up. That's why we associate with Jesus, because that's why he died to deal with all that. So we're free to associate and to see it for what it is. And I said, the second gift is we're free to turn. Is that the basic, and I did the language a little different because she's a little younger, but the basic assumption is that I can't feel good about myself if I haven't really accomplished something, or I've got to find a way in this world to establish my value and my worth. I got to work. I got to do something so that you'll see how valid I am. And when I see you validate me, then it makes me feel like I really am valid. And Jesus would say, I wouldn't do that. No amount of beauty that you have will last. No amount of power and money and success and status, none of that will last. No matter what people think of you now, no matter how highly they think, that can only go in one direction. That's going to go badly. You're going to lose. And Jesus would say, if you call this life, you are making a huge mistake because what you call life is actually death. All of this is perishing. All of this is disintegrating. All of this will abandon you and leave you abandoned. And even the idea that I'm going to acquire a bunch of stuff, I'm going to live as long as I can, even if you do keep your stuff all the way to the end, your stuff outlives you. So this, what you call life, is not life. Jesus says, I trade in all my glory and all my power and all my majesty, and I trade it in. I come here and I humble myself and I live a life as a humble man on this earth, perfect to die in your place. And I don't just die any kind of death, I die a criminal's death. So I humble myself. So in humbling ourselves, God can do great work. So he models it for us. But not just a model, he actually pours his spirit. When we trust in him, he removes our sin from us, puts his life and his spirit into us. And now he says, now you have real life that lasts forever. So now your significance and your value comes in the fact that you live and reign with him for all eternity, and this is just a small place. And some of us are going to have money here, and some of us are not. Some of us are going to look, be famous here, and some of us are not. But this is just nothing compared to what eternity is, where real life is. And so he says, so you're free. You're free to humble yourself. You're free to let that girl talk about stuff. She don't know what she's talking about. You're free to let that dude freak out, think he's on a power trip at work because he's going to run the world. You're free to let that go because it ain't going to last long, right? Let's worship together. Father, you see our beauty and our power, and you see it fading. We are putting our hope in the very thing that you are telling us will not last. Father, would you open our eyes to the fact that we are free in you to be honest about what we have and what we don't have. That we are free to be to move towards you, to turn away from that which we would cling to that we think gives us life but only brings us death. Father, would you be patient with us as you have been? Would you help us to see things as clearly as you do? Would you help us to trust in you and find our life in you? Help us to worship now as we say, we come underneath our Savior Jesus who died for us. We're saying that we trust in him. We want his mercy and his kindness towards us. In Jesus' name.
Church, before we continue to sing together tonight, take this opportunity to just sit.